Hey, welcome back to the Next Peak Podcast. I'm your co-host, Clint Herndon, and I am here with my favorite, Dr. Parker Houston. And hey, we've got an incredible treat for you today. Back by popular demand, we have the former Navy SEAL, Hank, in the house. And I'm going to let Dr. Houston tee this off, but we are here on episode 35, and we're going to talk about the four pillars of a winning mindset. Dr. Houston.
Hey, good morning. It is actually, it might be afternoon. It's afternoon where some of us are, and we're also battling the time change this morning, but it was in our favor this morning, so that was good. I just want to start off by saying I got such incredible feedback from the episode that you guys did. Lots of my friends that are heavy-duty psychologists and very academic and do not give out praise very easily, they praised Hank's prior episodes as just being super useful. So I know that people are going to get a lot out of this today. And I also just wanted to start off by saying, Hank, I didn't tell you this, but my dad was in the Navy for 30 years. And so, and I also worked at the VA hospital treating folks with post-traumatic stress disorder for a year. In Reno. So it is truly an honor to be talking with you this morning, and thank you for your service. So I wanted to start by saying that.
Oh, thanks, Doc. The pleasure is all mine. And thank you to your father, too, for 30 years of service. Man, that is quite a long time to serve in the Navy.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I know you're on this morning because you're going to be sharing a leadership model that you have been developing. And I know people are going to want to hear what you have to say. So why don't you start by giving us the overview and tell us a little bit about how did you decide that these particular concepts were the most important for developing a winning mindset, and what are they?
Oh, of course. So this is a formula, I guess you could say, that I've developed to teach my own clients in my own growth coaching practice. And they're nothing new, right? Like Hank didn't just come up with these things that everyone must do to be successful. It's stuff that as I've reflected and looked back on my life, when I've been really successful, I've happened to do these four things. When I haven't been successful, typically if not all four were nowhere to be found. And as I thought about my life and reflected on what I've done, and as well as listening to growth quality content, I realized these four things are super powerful. And it felt really cool to be able to name them and identify them as I looked back on things I've had great success with. So without further ado, the four pillars are, for the listeners who want to write these things down, we're going to go with ownership, optimism, vulnerability, and intentionality. The ownership, optimism, and intentionality kind of came pretty quickly to me once I looked into what has helped me with success throughout my career and my life. The vulnerability piece we kind of talked about last episode was something it took me a while to grasp. And when I've had great success in a team organization, every single person on the roster felt safe with one another, not just physically safe, but emotionally and mentally safe. They felt safe to open up. They felt safe to share ideas. They felt safe to be vulnerable with one another. So for the business leaders that are out there that are hearing this, that's a big piece we want to drive home inside of our teams, is having everyone feel safe to be with one another and promote that creativity. And we'll really get into that one. But all four of them, ownership, optimism, vulnerability, and intentionality, go a really long way.
Awesome. So if we're going to dive into these four in our limited time, let's take on number one. So why is ownership important? What is it? What do you do with it?
Yeah, let's just jump in. Ownership. So everyone knows what ownership is. That's when you take accountability for your actions. That's the Webster's Dictionary, right? Let's talk about what it really is, though. And that is when we not only take accountability for our actions when we've done well, but it's taking ownership when we've done really bad, or maybe we didn't get the desired outcome we were looking for. And once you truly take on ownership, I believe ownership takes on a different definition. I think ownership is pure empowerment. I think ownership allows us to realize that we are our own heroes in our own story. This is something you and I talked about last time, Clint, but we're going to expound on it a lot more today. And when you realize you're your own hero, you're not waiting for anyone else to show up and fix things for you. You realize there's no magic pill. There's no special diet. in the spirit of the election season, there's no candidate that's going to come along and be your hero, but it is truly on you to get out there and do it for you and own when you've done well or when you've done bad. And I like calling ownership empowerment, and some people kind of think that's crazy, but well, then they could just be wrong.
Yeah. One of the things that you and I talked about last time also that I still remember and I stick with it is this self-reflection piece. Cause you talked about kind of two things of success. And you talked about being prepared and then having strong self-reflection. And I think in this ownership category, I think a lot of us would claim to be owners, right? Owners of our life. Nobody's taken anything from me. I'm going to fight my way. But what's the true kind of self-reflection or litmus test that somebody can pay attention to say, gosh, I'm really not an owner. I'm giving away a lot of power, because you were talking about empowerment. So I'm giving away a lot of power. How can I get that back?
Well, we can't just do ownership when it's easy, right? Let's think of the average person, to include me, because I'm a human and we're all humans, human nature. We want to take ownership when we've done well. But how quickly do we point the finger at someone else when things don't go our way? Or to bring in a little humor here, how often do we blame the washing machine when our pants get too tight? You know, so, and I'm guilty of that still to this day. It's something that I don't think you'll ever 100% master in your life. It's just something you need to drive and try to apply to every aspect as hard as you can, but still giving yourself grace with knowing you'll always be growing, which is actually a lot of fun, because if growth is what we're all about and plugging in ownership is going to help with that, then we're going to increase our growth through ownership and our ownership through growth. And I think that that's a lot of fun, and it can be painful at times when you reflect, they're like, man, maybe I didn't own something in the manner I should have. One thing I tell my clients, I actually just spoke to some at-risk youth not long ago, and I blew their mind for about 10 seconds. I told them I could tell them the future. And they're like, well, you can? I'm like, yeah, I can tell you your future, my future, and your future over there. Your future, for all those listening, will look just like your past until you take ownership and realize you're the reason you are where you're at. Dogs are going to bark. Cats are going to meow. Sun's going to come up. Sun's going to go down. Spring, summer, fall, winter. It's going to go in that order. None of that changes. The only thing we can control is us. And until someone takes on that mindset, they will be leaving so much stuff, so much winning, so much success, so much happiness on the table. Because until you take on ownership fully, you will always point that finger somewhere else and claim someone else is the root of your problem. And in reality, it's you. You know, you're the problem and you're the answer.
You know, I was curious too when you started talking about this. I don't think I grew up in a household where there was a lot of ownership that was emphasized. And so I was curious for you, is this something that you were wired with initially, or how did the Navy kind of drill this into you? How did you develop this, and what changed in your life as a result?
I think like most people, maybe I had ownership here or I had ownership there in my life. Maybe if we look at the aspects of life, the wheel of life, maybe I take really good ownership in my physical health, but my financial health, I blame on not making enough money, right? Well, we're all pretty good with money here on the show right now. So we understand being good with money isn't about making more money. It's about behaving with money. So I learned that through my financial endeavors as well. But a good story I have from the Navy, when I was going through training, I was in the final 4 weeks of BUDS. You know, I'd gone through hell week, been up 5.5 days, done the whole thing. 4 weeks away from graduating, and I'm pretty excited at this point. Well, we go out to the mountains to learn a skill called land navigation, and that's where you learn how to plot coordinates on a map and then take your compass and that map and go find those coordinates. Well, I was really bad at it, up front. The first day you do it with a buddy. Well, the buddy I was doing it with grew up doing it, so we found every point. Like, I think you had to find 7 points. In 6 or 7 hours, we found every point like 3. It was ridiculous. I'm like, oh, this is easy. Oh, boy. Well, the next day, you go out by yourself, and I got lost. And you're supposed to check in like every 3 hours on the radio and say where you were. You were supposed to be able to plot your own coordinate of where you were. I'm like, hey, this is Navigator 38. I'm lost. Like, where are you at on the map? And I said, well, I'm not on the map. I've wandered off of it. Fast forward to Friday. I couldn't get my act together. Friday rolls around. It's the final day to test. If you don't pass, you're going to get dropped from training. So you could imagine the pressure I was feeling. 4 weeks away from graduating, the hardest military training in the free world, and it all comes down to this one day. I go out that day. I've got 7 points to find. I've got however long I have to do it. I know I have to be at the pickup location by 3 in the afternoon. 2 o'clock rolls around. I've got 2 points. I am 5 short, and I'm not. This is not a Navy SEAL physical story here where I go, yeah, I ran 20 miles in 20 minutes. I got hit with the realization that I was about to fail, and it was because I didn't put in the extra work the entire time we worked on this for the past 2 weeks, whether it was in the classroom or in a practical setting while we were in the mountains. So I have this like 50-pound pack on my back, and I'm walking to extract. I'm up on top of this mountain looking down into a valley. I still remember what this valley looks like to this day. And I take my rucksack off. I'm covered in sweat. I'm as tired can be. I'm hungry. My feet hurt. And I just sit down on my rucksack, and I realize I'm about to fail training because I didn't take ownership in knowing and being able to do what I needed to do. When everything was in a team setting like Hell Week, that was fine. I could mesh with guys. But when the chips were down and it was on me as an individual to get out there and do it, I didn't take it seriously enough. And I wasn't honest enough with myself to say a lot of extra work with this. Long story short, I ended up failing that day. They rolled me back to the next class, so I still got to graduate. But the guys I had been with for 6 months through all the trials and tribulations, you know, they went on to graduate, you know, a couple months ahead of me. So it kind of hurt not getting to have that celebration moment with them upon graduation. So that's where I really learned a hard lesson about ownership and the level of being honest with yourself when you need to be.
Wow. So final point on this, we can just do it very briefly too, so we have time for your whole model, but what can business leaders expect when they take more ownership of their life and their business?
I think they'll find a bit more freedom. As they get down the road, at first they'll realize, wow, they could very well realize this. They could realize, wow, there was a lot I was neglecting that I was simply pawning off and passing off on someone else. And so they may notice a lot more work and issues come their way. But what they'll feel is that sense of empowerment because they realize, okay, I'm going to be the answer to this issue. And then eventually, once you start pouring that ownership back into the aspects it needs to go, it'll be up and running a lot smoother than it was when you did your first assessment.
Awesome. And what I love about your story too, is that in life and work, you might get rolled back or you may not progress as quickly as if you were to just really focus on this ownership pillar. So for number two, I know is extremely important for you too, and that's optimism. So tell us about why optimism became the second pillar.
Okay. So for those of you who heard the last episode that I did with Clint, you'll remember me talking about my early days at the SEAL team level. I was just kind of blown out, bad mood all the time. And then when I came home from my first deployment, I made this growth transition where I decided to make some serious changes in my life. And what I didn't talk about last episode was having that constant mindset of an optimal outlook or an outlook of optimism, where no matter what's going on, you're finding somewhere in that event that you can become a better person for yourself, whether it's becoming a better SEAL, a better communicator, a better leader, a better land navigator, if you're me a couple years ago. And I think this level of optimism and understanding that there's always growth to be had keeps you in the fight longer than if you're running around with this mindset of like, ugh, what are we doing here? Why am I here? You know, I'm doing like Clint, I'm doing these people's taxes and they don't even care about it themselves. They're, you know, I keep telling them they need to get on a budget, but they won't do it. Well, at the end of the day, like you're their guy and eventually you're going to break through to them, or no matter what leader you may be in whatever realm of business it could be, the fact is you're there to lead and you've got to have this outlook of optimism that you get to lead and influence lives in a positive manner.
Awesome. And I know you shared something, in your model that I think is really incredible. Maybe you can elaborate on it a little bit. You say in there that if you aren't optimistic for your own life, then you won't expect anyone else to have that same optimism in their life either. So can you elaborate on that a bit more?
Yeah. So that's where I kind of start to tie ownership and optimism together, because you have to own your attitude. We can't always control our initial thoughts or feelings about something. You know, if I were to kick you in the knee, you know it's going to hurt and you're going to have a reaction that you don't even think about. Same thing's true in life. Things are going to come your way that you won't like at first, but you can always control your attitude of how you're going to go about it. You can show up. You can make sure you're showing up on time with a good attitude, with the things you need. And yeah, just to expound on that, Doc, if you're not optimistic about your future, who are you going to expect to be optimistic for you? Because if you're not optimistic about your own life, no one else is going to do it for you. And just like I alluded to, once we tie in optimism and ownership together, well, now we got two things singing in harmony. And then as we continue down the other pillars, what people will start to find is like, man, not only are these pillars, but these pillars are interwoven. And having that good mindset with everything we're going about, I promise to anyone listening, will severely change the way you go about business.
Yeah. You know, I although I'm a psychologist, I'm also trained as a coach, and I went through the world's largest coach training program about 2 years ago. And one of the things that they say that you're making me think of right now is they drill into you, they show up how you show up. And they just say that repeatedly. So what does that bring to mind for you?
Well, exactly. So I'm working with a media group down in Florida. And when I spoke to the leaders, I think they're working through a cultural shift right now. And I asked the leaders, if you don't show up happy and believing in the mission, how can you expect the people below you to show up and believe in the mission? Like, you drive that, especially as a leader. And one thing, I think where people get really confused about optimism, because I know in the wrong crowd, if you say optimism, they just think of this almost like cartoon character of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, like squirrel, like, oh, just so happy for everything. Well, optimism isn't about, let's see how we word this. It's optimism's not about being ignorant to the fact that something may be hard or a challenge, but optimism is knowing in every challenge, there's an opportunity. And when you take that on, no matter how simple, mundane, hard, difficult something may be, when you're optimistic for your reasons of doing things and you're constantly looking for where that gem may be to grow into, you're going to find it. When you're not looking for it, you'll never find it, you know? So let's at least look for that opportunity to grow, and you'll more than likely find it every time.
And Hank, when you were going through the transition that you talked about with your finances and everything else in your life that you were trying to be more optimistic about, what had to change in that process? Just like you're saying, it wasn't a fake thing. You didn't just bounce out of bed every day and go, oh my gosh, my life is so great, so wonderful, so beautiful today. But what had to change in you in order to find that optimistic perception?
I think what changed in me was my vision of where I wanted to go. So for the first time in my life, I had this well-rounded vision of where I wanted to take it. Not just a vision of being physically better, not just a vision of more money for finance, but a vision for my entire life. And once you have that, that in itself will make you optimistic, because now you start to see hope that you're growing for and going after. So every day now that you're waking up, yeah, you might be tired. Yeah, you might be hurting. Yeah, you're not there yet, but you know you're getting there. And knowing you're getting there is just half the battle when it comes to having this optimistic outlook. Because for the first time in my life, I could actually see what success was going to look like. Mm. Not just like, man, I hope I make this better. But instead, I had these definitive qualitative things I was working towards.
Yeah, and I think one important distinction people might be wondering about is the difference between optimism and just positive thinking. So maybe you have some thoughts you can share on that.
Ooh, that is tough. Well, I think with optimism, you're constantly finding the good in everything, right? So I got one day, when I was younger in my career at work, I got tasked with going to speak on some, like, I wasn't tasked as a speaker. Like, hey, we just need you to go listen to this thing because the big leaders are going to be there. I'm like, oh, okay. So basically they just needed butts and seats, to be blunt. Well, they actually ended up asking these butts in seats what they thought of the current mission we were working on. And it actually allowed me to create content for the direct leadership to hear. And so finding that and with that optimism, like, okay, well, at least I get to communicate to the leader. Whereas positive thinking is just like, I think people look at it as like, yep, things are going to go good. Yep, things are going to go good. Whereas optimism kind of gives you that better vision of what you're driving towards. And I hopefully that's what you're looking for, Doc, because that's a loaded question you just gave me.
Sorry, I didn't mean to set you up with that, but I think that did stand out what you said to me when you talked about vision. It seems like there's a link between optimism and vision, whereas positive thinking is, despite my circumstances, despite what I'm doing for my future, I'm just going to try to think positively. But it seems like optimism is much more active. It's geared towards, even in your coaching practice, I'm sure that you're helping clients see something and kind of actively design their future.
Exactly. Exactly. That's it, Doc. Like, you just worded it better than I could have.
And if we're looking at optimism, your third point, which is creating the sense of vulnerability and safety, you, on the surface, somebody might think, oh, those are kind of diametrically opposed. But in fact, if you're creating optimism, then you're allowing people to be vulnerable within that. And I won't steal the thunder, but it seems like you're actually creating opportunities for them to change and to grow and to admit that they aren't where they want to be.
Oh yeah, 100%. And what the big thing with the safety vulnerability is, I guess we should word it better. I should give it some more wording. So we want our team members to feel safe and to open up their vulnerability in terms of helping us achieve that level we're looking for as a team. I think it was Larry David. I may have the name wrong, but it was one of the former directors of Saturday Night Live. And one thing he was notorious for was when they would collaborate and make skits inside of the junior comedians, or what we would call the new guy on the team, is if that person was being silent at a creativity meeting, he would just call them out. He didn't care if Chris Farley and Adam Sandler were up and running and like taking lead on everything. He would look over at said junior comedian, we'll call him Clint, and he'd go, Clint, you're a world-class comedian, man. I haven't heard from you all day. What's going on? Like, no, we're not leaving until you contribute to this skit. Like, I understand it's intimidating, but get this, we need your creativity. We need your mind. We need your humor. What are you thinking right now? And he would almost bully his way into creating a sense of safety. And he would start it at the quote bottom of the totem pole. So the SEAL teams, the relativity to that would be the new guy compared to the really old guy. So I had a senior chief, that's a very senior leader in the Navy that I worked with once. And his thing was creating a roundtable discussion. And after any mission or operation we would do, we would come back and debrief and hot wash it. And he would lead it, but he would always want to hear what the new guys thought about it. So he didn't care if you had 10 years or 10 minutes in the SEAL teams. He knew there was value in everyone's in everyone's vision and in their mind, and he wanted to hear from everyone. And what's really cool, when you start asking really young SEALs what you thought about a mission or operation, is that they don't have years and baggage of scars and bad habits that they've learned along the way. So they have this fresh, open mind to that they're looking through. And sometimes they may say something so simple but so profound, you're like, where did that come from? And that's why we employ everyone on our roster, whether we're SEALs, CPAs, doctors, business, corporate, it doesn't matter. If you can create that sensitivity, or that, not sensitivity, that vulnerability, but sense of safety amongst everyone, that, hey, you're allowed to pitch your ideas. You're allowed to ask questions. We want you to ask questions, because if you don't understand something, someone else probably doesn't understand it either. And it only benefits the team for you to understand everything as best as you can.
I just have to say too, just as a quick side note, I love that, because my colleague and I teach leadership workshops at our workplace in our organization. She was in the military. She was in the Army for a long time. And so we use a ton of the SEAL information, which when I look at it from a psychological standpoint, it absolutely blows my mind the way that the SEALs are using psychology to shape people into healthy, non-egotistical, driven leaders. And so I just think it's amazing hearing from you. Like when you talk about the hot wash, it's like when you get back from an incident and you have to debrief it and talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly, you're going to learn and you're going to get so much from that. So I think it's amazing that you guys do that. So what an honor to be part of that process for you, I'm sure.
Oh, that's cool, man. It definitely feels like we're herding cats sometimes and trying to make progress with that. One story about that same leader I'll share really quick. This is a one-on-one story with me that made me feel like $1 million. So after that first deployment I shared with you guys, I came back, and that's when I worked with this guy, for him, under him, whatever you want to call it. Well, I got tasked with running training at our rappel tower one day. So rappelling, fast roping, a bunch of knots and all this stuff going on. And I had to run it for 60 guys. We had to get them qualified to be able to go do more stuff. But it started there that day at the tower. He comes up to me, goes, "Hey, Hank, we want you to run this." Da, 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 da. I'm like, cool. Well, I go back to my office and I'm building it on a computer for a day or so. And then I go up to him. I say, "Hey, man, this is what I got, but how do you want it?" He goes, "Dude, I don't care, man. Do what you see fit. This is yours. Take it and run with it." And what's crazy is this guy has been in the SEAL teams 20 plus years. He's forgotten more than I'll ever learn. And he's asking me for my opinion and my thoughts. He basically made me feel like the team needed me for its survival in terms of that evolution. And I legitimately felt like I was 10 feet tall and bulletproof at that point. I'd never worked for anyone who empowered people so well. And I know it sounds simple and you're like, "Hank, what do you mean? All you did was create training." No, I did a lot more than that, man. I grew 100% that day and through that time, as he allowed me to work as a human and plug in things that I saw fit, saw things that I do necessary. And then even that day when training was going on, he would come to my stations and just stand and watch and ask questions. Like he even opened up his own vulnerability. "Hey, Hank, what about if you're doing this?" And he didn't care that guys would see him ask questions. He thought it was, he knew he had things to learn. So even he opened up his own vulnerability in front of our entire troop. And he's supposed to be the subject matter expert in everything, but he'll gladly show you, "No, I'm not. I need my team for my own survival."
So let me ask you, what did he do as a leader to make sure that the rest of the group allowed the new people to have a voice? Because sometimes there's bullies in the room, and even though the leader's saying, "Hey, I want to hear from everybody," some of the other guys are like, "This guy, he doesn't know anything. He's green. You know, I don't want to hear this guy's opinion." And they either project that kind of body language or they follow up later and say, "Dude, just keep your mouth shut." So how did this leader say, "Hey, this is how we operate here"?
That's a perfect question, because we had a bully in the room. So he was over 60 of us. And under that hierarchy, I was under another chief. So that chief fell under him, but I fell under that chief. And that chief was kind of that bully. "You're going to do it how I say. I'm going to tell you how it's going to get done. That's how you're going to do it. And you're not going to ask questions why." I'm like, oof. So it was quite the dichotomy to have both of those leaders. And eventually the senior chief, the older, just sat him down and said, "Hey, man, this is my show. And this is how I see it fit. This is how I saw it fit for years. This is how we did it when I was at Team 6. And this is how we're going to do it here. And we're going to do it because it actually works." But what's interesting is he was still asked that guy for his questions and inputs. He never once muzzled that guy. Mm-hmm. He still found his strengths and let him, and he would pour into those strengths. And in turn, that guy looked like a really, really good platoon chief. And he really was. He just struggled with letting that power piece go as a leadership figure. So what was really cool is the two different types of leaders, but the empowering one was the top leader in that whole endeavor, and to see that other leader change. And he actually, by the time we were on deployment, found value in plugging into the junior guys and other guys who aren't necessarily experts, but still allowing them to feel ownership in our own product as a platoon.
One of the things you probably know about our podcast is we talk a lot about not just about workplace leadership, but being successful really has maybe more even to do with leading your family. So can you share at all just about what vulnerability, leading your family in a vulnerable way or creating that environment of safety at home, what that does?
Yeah. So in short, my wife and I both lean into each other on that. And we've gone to couples counseling, and our counselor will tell you, Hank, you think like a woman, and that my wife thinks more like a man. So it's really interesting that we kind of do that, but we both understand that. So you might find me doing stuff at our house, you're like, your wife doesn't do that, or stuff that she's doing where people are like, your husband doesn't do that. But it's okay, because what we understand is that this is going to make a better fruition within our family. And it's about what the family needs, not about what Hank's ego needs.
Awesome. And what will that kind of leadership do? So you talked about marriage application. What will it do for children in the home?
You may have a better grasp on this than I do, given the doctorate by your name. But I firmly believe that the best thing kids can have isn't a certain school system. It's not a certain application on your phone. It's the fact that they know undoubtedly that their father loves their mother, especially that way. And then undoubtedly that their mother loves their father, and that they will pick up on weird resentments and feelings that you may have amongst your spouse. And they'll carry that as their own insecurity. They may think it's their fault. So we're very intentional with how we talk and treat each other, especially in front of our kids. Like, we're intentional about it in general, but you're not going to ever see me have a somewhat of an aggressive tone towards my wife if my kids are around. There's just no room for that. So they 100% know that they are loved beyond words by both of their parents. And then when it's time for them, it's time for them, and they get it. And we're really truly blessed with two wonderful boys. But I also think the fact that we've been so intentional with that is why they're so full of love as well.
Awesome. Well, before we transition to the fourth pillar, which is intentionality, is there anything else that you wanted to share with safety and vulnerability?
I just think that it's not necessarily another story, but just to drive that point home, as I opened up to the audience in our last episode and sharing that vulnerability with people as they walk through their own problems, that we as leaders and as humans need to remember every human we ever meet for the rest of our lives will have their own bag of issues. We don't need to be a part of that bag. We need to be a part of that solution for them.
You know, a quick comment on that is just that Clint and I were both very impacted by our men's pastor at our church, who ran these really intimate leadership groups for men. And one of the things he would do is he was extremely raw and vulnerable, sometimes unnervingly so, with sharing just his private sins and struggles and the things that he was going through and arguments with his wife. You know, processes with his own addictions and his past. And what we would observe is he would open up with this stuff and lead. And then you'd start to watch every guy in the room start to really, it was as if he was giving them permission to really open up and share these things so that they could get into the daylight and get addressed. It was just an awesome thing. So yeah, it sounds like, go ahead.
No, that's too cool, because anyone could say, hey guys, open up, be vulnerable. I want to hear it. But he didn't do that. He showed it.
And exactly.
As leaders, you have to remember, it starts with you.
Awesome. So moving into the fourth pillar of your model and talking about intentionality, share with us why this is so important.
Well, this pillar shouldn't surprise anyone, especially if they listened to the last episode I did. Intentionality is it. I don't want to call any one pillar more important than the other, but without intentionality, you're leaving a lot on the table. You're leaving performance, happiness, financial, everything you can think of will be left on the table if you can't pour intentionality into your life. Big Bible verse that I like for this is, where there is no vision, the people perish, which is huge with having a vision for your life, like we alluded to earlier. But that's also having that vision so you can be intentional. MC Hammer had no money plan, and MC Hammer has no money now. There was no intention going on there. He blew it fast, and now he's left with nothing. And
he had some nice pants, though.
He did have really good pants. But that's it's crazy, though, right? Because we can all sit back at someone like MC Hammer and go, man, if only I had been given all that money, I wouldn't have done anything bad with it. Well, challenge question for folks. If you haven't maximized your gifts God's given you already, what makes you think he's going to give you more? And that's where we really have to look at ourselves and be honest and quit looking at other people's faults and the stories that they may produce and look at our own and go, man, where do I need to plug this into my life even more?
Don, in your model. Think? Oh, go ahead.
No, I was literally asking you, what do you think?
I was just going to say one thing that I saw in your model was that you call intentionality a performance-enhancing drug or like a superpower. Say more about what you mean for that.
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that because I really enjoy talking about that. I think it's the thing no one's talking about. You remember? Have you ever seen movies when someone has like this awakening moment, whether it's a sports movie and like this guy realizes, or Rocky, where they realize, oh no, they're all on steroids and I'm not. I'm not telling people to get on steroids, but what I'm saying is once you see intentionality for what it is, and then we take a step back and go find these really high performers, they're all performing with intentionality. And that's what I mean. It's almost like how people are like, oh, the Hollywood secrets of the rich and famous. This is it, folks. Intentionality. I've seen a ton of sports games in my life, and I've watched many Super Bowls and national titles, and I've never seen a reporter go to the winning coach and go, coach, you just won the national title. How'd you get there? And he goes, I don't know, man. We just showed up and won. Like, that's not how it works. They don't fumble their way to the top. They have a path, and they do a march on that thing, and they get there. They get to the top. One of my clients, I don't know how many sports fans we have listening, but one of my clients played football at Clemson, won two national titles there, one of which beat Alabama like a drum. And on that second national title that they won, he told me, he said, Hank, we knew we were going to win the national title before the season started. Like, could you imagine that? Major college football is about as competitive as it gets. And Alabama's sitting on the throne back then. And to know you're going to win the national title, that there's nothing anyone can do about it, like, woo, that is next level stuff. And he told me as they were practicing, getting ready for the playoffs and getting ready to head out west for the national title, he said, I was walking off the practice field for the final night and I just stopped. And I looked at my buddy and I said, dude, we're going to stomp a mud hole in these guys. And he said, I didn't mean it through being cocky. I just knew we were going to do it. He didn't know that from like, you know, halfway watching film or halfway practicing. He knew it from the work they had been putting in for months and even years leading up to this point. So if that's how they're doing it, why aren't we?
And how does somebody kind of design their intention, right? Because we all want to be good fathers. We all want to be good husbands. We all want to be good leaders in our workplace. But that's kind of abstract, right? So what is it, if you're going to boil this down, how does somebody start to design their intentions so that they can start to build their life and their habits around that?
Right. I think, one, figuring out where you want to go. Can't get there if you don't know where it is, you know? So one, figure out where you want to go. What do you want your life to look like? What does success look like to you? And write it down. There's been studies out there, Doc, I'm sure you're familiar with these, that if you write a goal down, you're 40% more likely to achieve it. So there's your cheat code right there if you need it, folks. Write it down. And then after you've identified what you want it to look like, just start making baby steps in that direction. So with clients of mine, when I do follow-ups with them, not a follow-up session, but let's say we have a session on a Monday. By Wednesday or Thursday, I'll email them a follow-up. And none of them are huge. They're actually just little small steps, but they're steps in the right direction. So that's what I would recommend to people listening. Don't feel like you have to go lose 100 pounds in 1 week. Just lose a pound over the next few days. And figuring out what direction it is and start taking baby steps. And then to go along and tie that intentionality in, is write down action items you can do that will make those steps happen. So let's talk about weight loss. Let's say I want to lose 20 pounds or whatever number, doesn't matter. Well, what do you need to do to do it? Don't do things like write diet and exercise. Those are just words. Be specific with what you want to do. Okay, I need to move more. Therefore, after every meal, I'm going to go for a 10-minute walk around the block. Boom. That's it right there. That's very simple and it's easy. You don't have to get a gym membership. You don't need weights. You just walk. And then doing other things, write it down. When I go to the grocery store, I'm only going to buy these items. And I'm not going to go when I'm hungry because then I'm going to buy a lot of chocolate or whatever it is that I don't need to buy. So all these little implementations eventually make one big picture. What are those pictures called? Mosaics, where it's a bunch of little dots, like thousands of little dots, but it turns out to make up this beautiful painting. That's exactly what your life is once you start using intentionality.
You know, by the way, I know you're going to be giving a talk on this at some point soon. So it's Gail Matthews, who's the psychologist out of Dominican Republic that did the famous goal study you're referring to. So I'll send you the link afterwards to use in your talk.
But yeah, I do need to cite my works, I guess.
Oh, that's all right. No, your citation is your military credibility and all your incredible learning there. But one thing I know I heard you talk about in the prior episodes, how passionate you were about Financial Peace University. It absolutely rocked my wife and I because we were hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt before coming across Dave Ramsey. And one thing we noticed, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on this too, we felt like once we learned Financial Peace University, we could almost apply that model of being intentional to all the other parts of our life, whether it be gaining parenting tools, being far more purposeful with our marriage, our health. And so Financial Peace was just this huge blueprint to take into other areas of our life. And sounds like you had a similar experience.
Oh yeah. The foundations and principles that apply within Financial Peace University, it's more than just save $1,000 and pay off debt. It's here's your plan, AKA your vision. And here's your intentionality of how you're going to go about it. And once you learn how to translate that to other aspects, you'll really see everything else starts to enrich. So I love FPU. I love everything Ramsey Solutions puts out. But honestly, what I would say I've learned the most from Dave is harnessing intentionality and doing things like that. It's not like I hate when people are like, oh, Dave Ramsey, the get out of debt guy. I'm like, no, Dave Ramsey is one of the best thought leaders in America and probably of our generation because of his ability to lead and teach people how to live intentionality and dig out the real root of the problem and not just treating the symptom. Mm-hmm. And once you learn how to see through the lens of looking for the root of an issue, you're going to notice things change big time in your life.
Awesome. Well, hey, we're just about out of time, but do you want to run over the four pillars one more time and add in anything else before we wrap up?
Yeah, absolutely. So the four pillars we worked on and talked through today are ownership, optimism, vulnerability/safety, and intentionality. And what I hope for people is, like I alluded to with ownership and optimism, is how we showed that example of weaving the two together, is that not only you learn these four pillars, but you learn how to make them mobile and weave them together, almost like a DNA strand. And that's when you'll really start to see they become stronger than just pillars, and they really can propel your life forward.
Final question that I had, we can do this quickly, but I know you're a person of faith, like Clint and I are, and sometimes we'll add just an element of that to the show. And how does your faith apply to this model that you just shared with us today?
It's huge. I think with all four of these, you can go find Bible verses on all four of them. You know, I alluded to where there is no vision, the people perish. That 100% ties into intentionality. But then when you look at taking ownership of your life, like, man, if you don't have a vision for your life, it's going to perish. The Bible tells you right now. And so it is really cool when you stumble across or you find Bible verses that can tie in all of these pillars. And then it's just reaffirming that, like, yeah, this came from God. Like, I am doing the right things. I'm on the right path.
That's awesome. I love what you said. You said it a couple times during this, that as a leader, it starts with you. And all four of these, if you want a successful marriage, a successful business, successful kids, it has to start with the leader. And as you've made these changes in your life, have you seen the fruit of the changes?
Oh yeah, 100%. Whether it's been the financial stuff, like I alluded to last time, and just the little things in life, not that you ever want to compare yourself to anyone else, right? But when I look at some of the problems that I know people have, you know, personal friends, like, I'm so thankful to not have these. But where does that come from? Well, one, it comes from God. Gifts from God. I've been blessed beyond words. But knowing that we've deliberately sown these things, we've sown intentionality, we've sown leadership, we've sown vulnerability and being safe with one another. And when I say we, I mean my wife and I at this point. And we've deliberately sown these pillars. And one of the things I was telling the teens I spoke to not long ago was, you reap what you sow. And that's another biblical one. I didn't come up with that either. You know, every spring farmers plant corn, and in the fall they harvest corn. But when you plant nothing, you know what you get? Weeds. You get far worse than nothing. You get weeds. Mm-hmm. When you're not being intentional and minding your field, things are going to come in there. Wild animals are going to come in there. Hogs are going to till up the ground. Weeds are going to grow. And then you get to the point where even if you wanted to grow, you have to get the weeds back out of your life before you can even get back to tilling the land up and planting your seeds and being intentional and sowing something to reap it later. And so it all starts with you, though, you know, especially if we look at the ownership thing, your financial problems, your health, your physical, your status at work, you know what they all are? Yours, no one else's.
Love that. Anything else that you want to add before we wrap up?
That's it, guys. I appreciate you for having me back. Doc, thanks for making the appearance. It's great to speak with you today.
Yeah, great to talk with you too. Like I said, people were your episodes were wildly popular. And I know that people getting to hear from the military training you've had and some of the wisdom of the Bible, what an awesome kind of marriage of those two worlds that you've shared with us today. So thank you so much for your time.
Cool. Thanks. Thanks, Doc.
Yeah. And hey guys, if anybody out there wants to connect with Hank, he's been generous and given out his email address. It's growthcoach@highgroundlife.com. We'll also have that in the description for the podcast. But if you would like to contact him about either coaching or speaking at an engagement, he would love to talk with you. But that's all we've got for episode 35. Thanks so much for tuning in. Please download, subscribe, share this with a friend. And we love to get reviews. It moves us up the charts, and we're just trying to help people out. So please continue the support. And we're going to wrap up season 2 with episode number 36 next week. And then we've got some surprises coming for season 3. So, hey, thanks for tuning in to the Next Peak podcast. Until next week, keep climbing your next peak.